KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, June 20th, 2002, for broadcast at this time. Today's topic will be diabetes, treatments, research, and the future. Our special guest speakers will be Dr. James T. Lane, assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and a nationally recognized diabetes expert, and Margaret Booman, medical reporter for KETV Channel 7 and herself an insulin-dependent diabetic. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Chris Allen, assistant professor in the Department of Communications, the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Allen. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and I had the pleasure of moderating this afternoon's Press Club Forum. At least once a month, the Press Club, through its education committee, sponsors a forum of interest to club members and to the community at large. The forums are open to everyone, and you don't have to be a member of the Press Club to attend. The American Diabetes Association says diabetes is reaching epidemic proportions in the United States, especially type 2 diabetes. Type 2 is often called adult onset diabetes and comes about as the result of the body's inability to make or properly use insulin, which is the hormone that converts starches and sugars into usable energy. The tremendous increase in type 2, according to the ADA, is the result of an aging population and our sedentary lifestyle, which leads to obesity. My mother, just a few years ago, was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is less common. It develops among children and young adults when the body fails to produce insulin. These are generally the people who must take daily insulin shots. Diabetes is often thought of as an invisible disease. Many people who have diabetes live what look like normal lives to you and me. I remember when I was growing up being surprised at finding some of my playmates and schoolmates were diabetic. I had no idea. But the consequences of diabetes, of course, are severe. Diabetics are at a high risk of heart disease, circulatory problems, and other illnesses. It takes an enormous toll. Last weekend, I was at the College World Series with my son, and between games on Sunday, we went down to the food area to have a bite to eat, and we sat at a table with a gentleman who was in his 50s or 60s, and we struck up a conversation, and he had a large ring on his finger, and my son asked what that was for. It looked like a championship ring. And my son said, "What's that for?" And he pulled the ring off his finger and said that it was for having bowled a 300 game in a league one time. And he said it was back in the 80 or 81. And he said rather sadly, it must have been quite a thrill. And he said, "Yeah, it was." He says, "But I can't bowl anymore. I have diabetes, and I've had to give that up." So it took a recreation away from that gentleman. We're happy to have with us today two people to talk to us about diabetes, about new treatments, about living with the disease. Dr. James Lane is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He is a nationally recognized diabetes expert and researcher. He, of course, teaches about the disease. He works with patients, and he is involved in developing and evaluating new therapies. You've seen Margaret Booman for years as a reporter and anchor for KETV in Omaha, but you probably didn't know that she's also a diabetic. She is a patient of Dr. Lane's, and she's going to talk to us about living with the disease and how the therapies and the disease have affected her life. I've asked each of them to speak to us for about 15 minutes, and we'll leave the rest of the time for questions. We'll ask the questions from here at the podium. At each table, there are pencils and slips of paper that you can jot your question on. We'll come around and pick them up, collect them, and ask them from up here. So I think we'll begin today with Dr. Lane.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here, and I was going to focus my talk today on the recent announcement by the Department of Health and Education out of Washington, D.C., and Tommy Thompson's decision to relabel a condition that we know as impaired glucose tolerance as prediabetes. And this is important because the most common form of diabetes, known as type 2 diabetes, affects 90% of all people who have diabetes. And we think that type 2 diabetes may occur with a pre-disease that Tommy Thompson wants to refer to as pre-diabetes. I think in large part he's made that decision because impaired glucose tolerance didn't sell. People didn't understand what that meant. And it was very hard to translate that to patients so that they really could get a grasp of what their doctor was telling them. And then the second piece of information that really has helped to focus on this topic is the fact that we now have results from a very large multi-center trial that says that there are ways to actually prevent diabetes if you have prediabetes. In other words, if you're at high risk, we can actually prevent it from occurring with specific therapies, and we'll talk a little bit about that today. The one more thing I might add is that over the last 10 years, diabetes has been a increasingly popular disease to talk about. It has gained more attention nationally. It has garnered more research dollars in the last 10 years, so that there's been a lot of inertia for trying to evaluate and treat and prevent diabetes, and there should be. Most people with type 2 diabetes die cardiovascular death. Their rate of cardiovascular death is fourfold over the entire population. Diabetes is the most common cause of blindness in working-age individuals in this country. It's the most common reason for individuals entering into a dialysis center for hemo or peritoneal dialysis, and it's the most common cause of non-traumatic amputation. And it takes roughly 15% of the gross national product to take care of people with diabetes. So those are some sobering statistics. Well, prediabetes is certainly not diabetes. And what we had previously to make the definition was a test that you may be familiar with called an oral glucose tolerance test. And no one liked to take an oral glucose tolerance test. The glucose tastes bad. It makes you nauseated and requires multiple blood sticks. But it really was the best test that we had to perform and still is probably the most sensitive test that we have to use. And with the oral glucose tolerance test, we could identify people who were really not normal but really didn't have diabetes, and we called them impaired glucose tolerance. And now we're calling that or renaming that prediabetes. And this is taken from the American Diabetes Association's website. Our definition of prediabetes now is a blood glucose levels that are higher than normal but not yet high enough to be diagnosed as diabetes. Previous diagnoses of impaired glucose tolerance were really impossible with any test except the oral glucose tolerance test. Back in 1997, the American Diabetes Association went about reclassifying diabetes. And with a single fasting glucose, they were able to indicate that normal blood sugars really should be less than 110. Whereas prediabetes represents a fasting blood sugar between 100 and 126, and individuals with diabetes have blood sugars in the fasting state, which means before they eat in the morning, of greater than 126. And to have diabetes, you have to have elevated levels on more than one occasion. And that is the emphasis now in terms of how we make those decisions. And when the American Diabetes Association decided that they were going to make those changes, when they lowered the fasting blood sugar requirement from 140 to 126, instantly 3 million people in the United States developed diabetes. The purpose was not to be a penalty to those individuals, but was to emphasize the fact that they needed care because there were end-organ complications resulting as a result of not treating them. However, it does become more difficult to get insurance, and there are a lot of other issues related to being diagnosed with diabetes. Other terms that you might have heard of that might have been used with impaired glucose tolerance or prediabetes would include insulin resistance, syndrome X, or the metabolic syndrome. Syndrome X and the metabolic syndrome refer to a constellation of findings that include increased blood lipids, an increased risk of heart disease, an increased risk of diabetes, central obesity, and hypertension. And a very large percentage of the American population fall into that category. Now, probably the single most important point to be made about trying to identify individuals with prediabetes is the fact that individuals with this designation of prediabetes have a risk of coronary artery disease or hardening of the arteries of the heart that put them at risk for heart attacks that is almost as great as individuals with diabetes. The increased risk of coronary artery disease is probably 3-to-fold higher than the general population. And so one of the themes that I want to present today is that the damage and the problems don't occur when you cross the boundary into diabetes. They occur long before that. So something is going on in individuals who have prediabetes that puts them at risk for heart disease. So not only are we preventing diabetes, but hopefully if we can treat these individuals earlier, we're having an impact on individuals who may develop heart disease later on. Another interesting fact in terms of the expression of heart disease is that women are disproportionately affected with heart disease if they have diabetes. I've listed for you several large studies that have actually looked at the overall increased risk of developing heart disease. And one of the things that you should note is that the increased risk is anywhere from 2 to 5 times that of the general population, with women almost consistently having a higher rate of heart disease than other women who do not have diabetes. Now, as Chris said in his introductory statement, diabetes is really in epidemic proportion. And one of the things that I want you to know is that there really is a changing face to diabetes. As our epidemic of obesity continues to increase and continues to display itself, we're finding an increase in the prevalence of diabetes in our general population. And not only are we finding more people with diabetes, but individuals with type 2 diabetes are presenting at a younger age. And that's really critical because we are now seeing individuals in their early teens that are developing type 2 diabetes, and we didn't see this 10 years ago. Usually type 2 diabetes was a disease of individuals greater than 40 years of age. And the bottom line is that those individuals that present with diabetes have an increased risk of developing at a younger age with heart disease. So instead of seeing heart attacks and strokes over the age of 60, my fear is that we'll see these individuals with heart attacks and strokes in their 40s. And we just got back from the scientific sessions of the American Diabetes Association this last week in San Francisco. And there was a report by a dedicated group of investigators in Manitoba that studied the Ojibwe population of Native Canadians there. And they showed that in their individuals that were diagnosed with type 2 diabetes at an age less than 20, had a 15-fold increased risk in death. So that is some preliminary evidence that suggests that that is really a negative outcome for this changing face of diabetes. Approximately 98,000 people with diabetes live here in Nebraska, and a third of those are undiagnosed. So that's another important point to be made, is that not everybody is diagnosed with diabetes. It really takes a blood test to know that. The other thing that's really important, too, is that our numbers for diabetes are roughly 20% higher than they've been over the last 10 to 15 years. Diabetes, and especially type 2 diabetes, disproportionately affects members from minority groups. So individuals that are African American or Native American or Hispanic are going to be at a much higher risk of developing diabetes and diabetes at an earlier age compared to Caucasians. As we start looking for ways to prevent diabetes, I think it's important to keep in mind how we're going to identify individuals who are going to be at increased risk. If you develop prediabetes, the overall chance of developing diabetes down the road over 10 years is very high in over 80% of individuals. So it really is a window of opportunity that we really need to use to our fullest advantage. These individuals come from families where diabetes is present in their other first degree and second degree relatives, such as mom and dad and cousins and aunts and uncles. For women, there are two diagnoses in early age that may predispose to diabetes. One of them is gestational diabetes, and that's where diabetes is first diagnosed when a woman is pregnant. And that really is a window into the future because a very high percentage of those women go on to develop diabetes. And in addition, polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a syndrome or a constellation of findings that include irregular menses from the time that women start having menses, obesity, acne, those individuals are also at increased risk for diabetes. If you have a sedentary lifestyle or poor lifestyle habits in general. And finally, there are some medications that put you at risk, and one of the really common ones are individuals who are taking steroid medications. The most common symptoms that occur in people who already have previously developed elevated blood sugars would include frequent urination and frequent thirst. What is happening there is that your body is really going to the bathroom more often because the very high glucose concentration causes you to make more urine. These individuals lose lots of calories through their urine, so they lose weight during this period of time. They have blurring of vision, and they feel fatigued and unable to carry on a lot of their previous jobs or occupations. Now, my final words are going to really be directed at what do we know about the development of diabetes? How can we find individuals at risk? And what kinds of therapies are available to us to try to prevent the onset of diabetes? And to make my point, I'd like to illustrate the idea that really diabetes and the diagnosis of clinical diabetes is really at the tip of the iceberg, if you will. That the individuals that we see in the clinic that already have diagnosed diabetes are way at the top of the pyramid. Rather, what we should be focusing on as a means of preventing getting to the top is looking at those people who are at increased risk. How do we know that? Well, hopefully we're seeing individuals for health maintenance over a lifetime so that we can identify individuals who have abnormal cholesterol levels, individuals who have mild hypertension, individuals who are already obese, which is a very important marker and one that hopefully would allow for intervention. There's the possibility that as we begin to know more about the genetics of diabetes that we can actually screen with specific genes, but right now we don't have the understanding of the development of diabetes to be able to do that. Then once we've identified those individuals, then the idea of trying to use an intervention to prevent the clinical progression of diabetes is what we want to try to do. And by preventing diabetes at an earlier stage, hopefully what we're doing is preventing the individuals who go on to develop heart attacks and blindness and kidney failure from diabetes. So on the one hand, you can really focus and say, well, this is really horrible. This is the sort of the end of the world. But I would rather try to emphasize the other side of it, that there are alternatives for people who are either at risk or who have diabetes. You may wonder, in individuals who have these risk factors, how they may play a role in terms of accelerating heart disease. We know that the elevated lipids make it more likely for these cholesterol molecules to end up forming the plaques inside the blood vessels. We know that diabetes probably represents an inflammatory condition where the blood vessels within the body actually become inflamed and they invite an inflammatory response that damages the blood vessels. There are some thought that elevated insulin levels may actually be damaging to small blood vessels. We know that elevated blood pressure causes shear damage to blood vessels. And we know that there are probably other genes that interact in a way that we don't quite yet understand. Now, there have been four trials that have actually tried to look at individuals who are at increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes and test an intervention to see if they were successful. And the good news is that these studies were successful in trying to prevent diabetes, and I'll just mention a few of those. The first is a Finnish study that looked at individuals that were roughly 55 years of age who were moderately obese, and what they did is that they looked at these individuals using a lifestyle intervention. So most lifestyle interventions mean that they worked on a hypocaloric diet to allow them to lose weight and also had some type of exercise prescription that they were able to follow. And with an exercise and diet strategy, there was a 58% reduction in the onset of type 2 diabetes over those 3 years that the study was done. Another study that's referred to as the Tripod study looked at 235 Hispanic women who had developed gestational diabetes. And remember, gestational diabetes was a disease that puts people at risk for later onset. And they tested them with a medicine called troglitazone. Troglitazone is a member of a group of medicines that are insulin sensitizers. And although it's not in the market now, there are other drugs of a similar class that don't have the same toxicity as those drugs do. And what they showed is that there was a 56% decrease in type 2 diabetes in that group. And then when they went back and studied them 8 months after the study was over, they still showed that there was still a beneficial effect of being in the study after those 8 months. Another study called the STOP NIDDM trial looked at roughly 1,500 people who had impaired glucose tolerance. They tested Acarbose, which is a less potent medication. And even with this less potent medication, they were able to show a 25% reduction after 3.5 years. Now, the United States and the NIH sponsored a multi-center trial that was the largest of all the intervention trials, and it was called the Diabetes Prevention Program, or the DPP. And it enrolled roughly 3,200 individuals, and these individuals were initially identified as being relatives of people who had type 2 diabetes, and they did an oral glucose tolerance test. And when they were found to have impaired glucose tolerance, or the term we're using now, prediabetes, they were entered into the study. And originally they had four arms of the study, which meant that they tested four different types of interventions. One of them was a lifestyle intervention. One of them was using the drug metformin, or trade name Glucophage, and the other drug that was tested was called Reslin or troglitazone. And then there was a fourth arm, which included a placebo group, which meant that that was the scientific control for the other individuals who were being tested. And in this group, the individuals were roughly 50 years of age, and they were more obese than the other studies that had a BMI of over 34. And what was also really helpful is that in this study, they went out of their way to try to find minority groups who were already at increased risk for developing diabetes. And they also had a population that's significant, with roughly 20% over 60 years of age. And in only 2.8 years, they were able to find significant reduction in the development of diabetes. And the two arms of the study that really were beneficial in showing this were both the intensive lifestyle, which showed a decrease of roughly 58% during that time, and the metformin group. Now, the metformin group wasn't quite as potent. It was only a 31% decrease. But we got some really important information from that study. Almost none of the individuals that were over 60 really benefited. So we think that if Glucophage or metformin is going to be an effective intervention, it probably should be in younger, more obese individuals as opposed to older individuals. And the intensive lifestyle, for those of you who are curious, was a decrease in weight of roughly 7% that and was also accompanied by 150 minutes of exercise per week. There's a significant difference between the interventions of lifestyle and metformin compared to individuals who did not receive a treatment over the period of the study. So this brings us to some conclusion in the effect of who do you really treat with prediabetes. And I think that that to begin with, we should still try to reinforce interventions that include weight loss and diet, because they have the least toxicity, the least side effects, and they allow people to hopefully try to modify and live a more healthy lifestyle. But in addition, individuals who have a very strong family history and may already have concomitant problems with blood pressure or lipid abnormalities may benefit from use with glucophage or metformin. And the other thing to really remember here is that you can't do this in a vacuum. You can't practice diabetes prevention and ignore other risk factors such as smoking that may play a role. And you can do other beneficial things too, which include a daily aspirin a day, work on blood pressure, and reduce salt and fat in your diet. And I think with that, I'd like to conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lane. Again, if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, please jot them down and pass them around. Our next guest this afternoon is a person that you've seen quite a bit over the years on the television, Margaret Boomen.
Hi, I'm Margaret, and I have insulin-dependent diabetes, which is much different than the type of diabetes that Dr. Lane was primarily referring to today. My speech is sort of a running commentary of things that have happened over the past few weeks. Wednesday, April 24th, my husband nudges me awake at 6:30. I remember I want to go for a morning run. I test my sugar. It's 46, very low. Doesn't matter. I'm still going for a run. I dress quickly, head downstairs to gulp a glass of orange juice. I leave my insulin pump at home. With a sugar that low, I won't need any exogenous insulin for the duration of my run. I plan to run my whole 4.5-mile route. Before I leave, I take half a small banana muffin for insurance. A low blood sugar can leave you feeling weak and tired. I haven't run for 2 days, so I should have lots of stored up energy. But the low sugar leaves me feeling like my legs are lead weights. I run a few blocks, then stop to walk while I nibble a few bites from the muffin. I hardly notice the morning, the new spring growth, the grass and leaves greening, the birds twittering, the sun climbing the sky. Instead, I'm calculating. If I walk just half a block more, that'll give my body time to absorb more calories, more glucose from the juice and muffin. Then it'll be safe for me to run, but there are no guarantees. Running or any physical exercise burns energy and calories and allows our bodies to use insulin more efficiently. So a diabetic patient has to learn to adjust his or her insulin levels when exercising. I'm hoping that if I take away the exogenous insulin during my run by leaving my pump at home and by eating some food before I head out, I'll achieve the right balance and get back from my run safely with a normal blood sugar. But there are other factors to consider. Our bodies release growth hormones during the night, and this can result in higher sugars in the morning. There's also something called the rebound effect. Sometimes a very low blood sugar will send a message to the pancreas to put out a hormone called glucagon, which can raise blood sugar dramatically. So while I'm initially treating a low blood sugar this morning, my body's natural release of growth hormone during the night, or a rebound effect from my fasting blood sugar, could soon be driving my sugars up. And there's no way for me to gauge what my meter will read when I get back from my run. It's simply a guess. As my feet pound the pavement, I'm frequently thinking about my blood sugar. It feels like it's rising. I feel my energy returning. I feel a surge of confidence. I'm also feeling tired, brain tired, tired of spending so much of my time thinking about something so banal, so boring. So I decide to turn my thoughts elsewhere. It's a conscious turning off of a subject I must pay attention to. Friday, June 14th. I wake up with a fasting sugar of 92. That's good. The night before, I'd run about 5.5 miles, so I'm thinking that today, even 12 hours later, I'll have lower than normal blood sugars. I have coffee and cream for breakfast, a handful of carrots in the car. I give myself a unit of insulin to cover the calories. When I get to work, I'm hungry, so I have a bite of a turkey sandwich. It's mostly turkey, and it's not lean, so I count it as half a fat. Then I enjoy a 6-ounce serving of sugar-free, fat-free yogurt, which counts as one carb. So I give myself another unit of insulin to cover that. 2 hours later, I'm hungry again and decide to eat an apple. I give myself 1.2 units of insulin. The apple looks like slightly more than one carb. Then I check my blood sugar. Imagine my surprise when it reads 421. I quickly boost 4 units of insulin to bring it down. Then I try to figure out what went wrong. I don't know. I can't fathom what went wrong. It happens to me a lot. I get wide swings in my blood sugar. Sometimes it's truly caused by erratic eating habits. Sometimes I do everything right, and it still happens. It's frustrating. It feels like I can't win. Sometimes I wonder why I even try. Only 5% of patients with diabetes are able to follow the guidelines and achieve the goals set out by the Diabetes Complications and Control Trial. The DCCT proved for the first time that patients who keep their blood sugars in good control have far fewer complications from diabetes. They have fewer heart attacks, fewer cases of kidney failure, less neuropathy or painful nerve damage, particularly to the feet and legs, less retinopathy or leakage of fluids and blood into the eye, which can cause blindness. But again, only a small percentage of patients are able to keep their blood sugars in the range where these benefits are reaped. Why? Because it's so difficult. Yet this is the best we can offer diabetic patients today, a treatment whose goals are achievable by so few. Many diabetic patients, myself included, fall off the wagon from time to time. If we begin to eat donuts for breakfast, Big Macs for lunch, and steak for dinner, we head for a diabetic crisis. We quicken our pace to diabetic neuropathy, which could lead to amputation of the feet and legs. We may become blind. Our kidney function could deteriorate to the point of needing dialysis or a transplant. We may end up with something called gastroparesis, a particularly gruesome complication of the digestive tract where the patient is literally unable to digest food. It stagnates in the gut and causes vomiting. Of course, all of these complications are more likely if the patient is not well controlled, but there's no guarantee that even if you're in stellar control, they won't happen. Is it a question of willpower? Absolutely. It takes a tremendous amount of willpower to live with diabetes. But there seems to be a disconnect in how diabetes is perceived by the patient as opposed to how it's perceived by the public. Many health professionals tell patients and family members alike, you can live a normal life, you just need to make some adjustments. I think that's flat wrong. I think it's a lie. I think it hurts the patient. It's not normal to prick your finger 4 to 12 times a day in order to get a blood sugar reading. It's not normal to give 2 to 7 injections of insulin per day. It's not normal to eat the same amount of calories, carbs, fat, and protein in the same configuration for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack every day. It's not normal to have to exercise at the same time each day, every day. It's not normal because most Americans don't live that way. I think it makes far better sense to tell it just like it is. I think patients newly diagnosed with diabetes ought to be told, you have a disease that is not going to be easy to manage or live with. You must make lifestyle adjustments that may be difficult and frustrating to achieve. And if you don't change your lifestyle, you could end up blind, on dialysis, an amputee, and in severe pain. That's the truth. Diabetic patients and their families need to hear it. Yes, we bear responsibility for our disease and to some degree whether we develop diabetic complications. But living with diabetes is far from normal, and telling patients that it is raises expectations so high that when the majority of patients fail to meet those expectations, they feel guilty and they're blamed for not taking care of themselves. Let's talk about blood sugars, lows and highs. I begin to feel a low at about 65. Diabetic patients are taught to treat low sugars with a formula. Start with 15 grams of a fast-acting carbohydrate like orange juice, about half a cup. Don't take in too many calories or your sugar will skyrocket, but not getting enough means the low sugar hangs on. If it gets low enough, your brain quits working. Without glucose, the brain malfunctions. I've had a sugar so low it caused a seizure. All I remember of that episode is feeling like I was dissolving into a deep, dark nothingness. I also remember hallucinating. It's terrifying to experience a low sugar and terrifying to witness it. How could I let that happen to me? That's what I ask. How could I let that happen? The opposite end of the spectrum is a high sugar. April of this year, I call into work sick. I can't get out of bed. My husband is staying home to take care of the kids because they're sick too. I can't move except painfully to vomit every 15 minutes. My blood sugar won't come down. I keep activating my insulin pump to give me ever-increasing amounts of insulin. My sugars bounce from 475 to 320 to 430 to 410. I'm beginning to get worried. Though I've never had it before, I realize I could be entering a state called ketoacidosis. I remember my sister having ketoacidosis. She's 4 years older than me and has had diabetes since the age of 12. I remember Irene sitting at the kitchen table in her pajamas and winter coat waiting to be brought to the hospital. She's slumped over, her eyes are closed, and she's nearly comatose. This was before we had the ability to do home blood glucose testing. I mistakenly thought that by keeping a close eye on my sugars, I'd never get ketoacidosis. I was wrong. Ketoacidosis happens when the body can't use glucose for energy and is forced to turn to body fats instead. Fatty acids are released into the blood and converted to ketones. You've heard of those ketogenic diets where the dieter purposely puts themselves into a state of ketosis in order to lose weight. For a diabetic patient, ketosis can mean death. Even though I'd never been thirstier in my life and I couldn't keep a drop of water in my stomach, I balked at being hospitalized. Little did I realize I was probably going to be comatose in a few hours. I finally told my husband to take me to the ER. I was in the hospital, in ICU, for 24 hours and in the hospital 2 days. Again, I asked myself, how could I let this happen? Self-blame for those of us who make every effort to live up to the diabetes code of ethics is very common and very dysfunctional. Blaming ourselves for the ramifications of erratic blood sugar control is sort of like blaming the garden for growing weeds. No matter how hard you try, erratic blood sugars are going to occur, just like weeds in an immaculately tended garden. March 1983. I'm a sophomore at the University of South Dakota. The year's not going well compared to my freshman year. The world was my oyster then. I loved college. I loved studying. I loved the new world of independence that had opened up for me. I was getting straight A's, except in math. I was dreaming big for my future. I felt I could do anything. The beginning of my sophomore year, I began to feel different. First, I noticed the fatigue, the difficulty of finding the energy to study. This had never been a problem before. I had an insatiable desire to learn. I was always hungry, but when I ate, my stomach rebelled. I was always thirsty and always in the bathroom. It came on very gradually, and I didn't take note until I fell into a deep depression. I was so tired, so exhausted. Simply using a curling iron to put bounce in my hair became painful because I didn't have the strength to hold the iron above my head for 5 seconds. My arm would simply give out. A straight-A student, except in math, I simply gave up on studying. I couldn't focus. I fell asleep 5 minutes after cracking a book. I didn't care if I got good grades. And that's what's so alarming. I was so sick, I didn't care. A year earlier, I wouldn't have been able to fathom feeling that dull and lethargic. I tend to view my life as before diabetes and after diabetes. Before, I felt freer. My world felt brighter. I was smart. I knew I could accomplish anything I set my mind to. After diabetes, my dreams died. They were replaced by new ones. Dreams with conditions, such as, I can accomplish this, but only if my diabetes is still in control. My dreams are still largely achievable, but it's a lot harder to get there. So please don't tell me or anyone else that living with diabetes is normal. The first semester of my sophomore year at USD, I wrote a speech on running that I delivered in a university-wide speech contest. I wrote about getting a runner's high as I logged 4 to 5 miles around the small city of Vermilion. I told how running shaped not only my quadriceps and hamstrings, it helped shape my mind. During my runs, I'd write papers for class. I'd have important conversations in my head that would shape the real day-to-day conversations of my life. I won that speech contest at USD, first place in oratory. I was proud of that. Several weeks later, I could hardly jog a block. Following Christmas vacation in 1983, I returned to school in Vermilion with ever-increasing fatigue, nausea, and all those other symptoms. Blurry vision, an unidentifiable skin rash. I was so thirsty, so tired. I began skipping classes, not studying for tests. I was so depressed, I began to cry about the future. I sought help at Student Health. A routine urine test gave me the answer. I had type 1 diabetes and needed to be hospitalized for spring break. I came back to college terrified of the strict regimen I was placed on. If I veered from this plan, my blood sugar would bounce like a bungee cord. For the first time in my life, I got less than stellar grades. One of my classes, Earth Science, didn't come naturally to me like German or English literature. I had to study, and I couldn't. I simply didn't have the energy physically or mentally. I remember taking my books to the library and becoming so fatigued or despondent about the enormity of care that my diabetes required that I'd leave half an hour after cracking the books. I also met the man who would become my husband during this time. Jim and I started dating shortly after I was diagnosed. Money was extremely tight back then. My parents were small farmers in Iowa, and we were in the middle of the farm crisis. I needed money to help me pay for school. Jim encouraged me to seek financial assistance from the Vocational Rehabilitation Office because, by definition, I was disabled by diabetes. I had a terrible time thinking of myself as disabled, but it was staring me right in the face. I could hardly get out of bed some days. Hope for the future, for me and for many people, especially type 1s and only type 1s, is islet cell transplantation. I recently got a call from a woman in small town Nebraska. She saw a story on ABC World News Tonight. I saw the same story. It was about islet transplantation, but not once did the report say islet transplant. Even I had a hard time judging what was news in this report. The story told about a woman with type 1 diabetes from Texas who had severe hypoglycemic unawareness. She couldn't tell when she was getting a low blood sugar and would simply pass out. You can die from not getting glucose to the brain. This woman was given an injection of islet cells into her liver. The procedure itself is nothing new. Many places around the country have performed islet transplants for years without success. The most encouraging results come from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Doctors there are using a new form of immunosuppression to prevent the islets from dying. That's been the biggest hurdle thus far. Most islet transplants have failed because the islets die after a few weeks or months. But the work in Canada is extremely encouraging. More centers in the U.S. are now duplicating the work there, but islet transplantation is still considered experimental. However, for patients like the woman from small town Nebraska, this might be a great option. I'll call her Dolly. Dolly also suffers from hypoglycemic unawareness. One minute she's fine, the next she loses consciousness. She says the last time it happened, the plumber found her passed out on her living room floor. Dolly had seen the ABC News report and wanted to know if I knew anything about it. I told her the procedure wasn't new, but it was experimental, and doctors in Omaha were planning to start an islet cell transplant program right at UNMC. I told Dolly perhaps she should consider being evaluated for an islet transplant. She began to cry. She said, "I don't want to live this way anymore." Then Dolly told me her doctor said an islet transplant wasn't for her. Now, perhaps this patient truly isn't an islet transplant candidate. Perhaps her doctor feels she lacks the motivation or determination to care for herself post-transplant. That's a judgment call. But this was a patient who needed hope. She had no idea the procedure was going to be done in Omaha, and she appeared to have no clear answer as to why she wasn't a candidate for the procedure. Dolly lives a life severely hampered by her illness. Indeed, her illness could kill her. She desperately wants diabetes to loosen its grip. But without a transplant, either whole organ pancreas or islet transplant, she is tied to and being smothered by her diabetes. When I was initially diagnosed and learning how to micromanage my lifestyle, I was often crushed by a feeling of failure. Instead of recognizing the small but important successes I was having in dealing with such a complex disease, my perfectionistic personality tended to focus on the failures. What kept me going and keeps me going today is the hope offered by new treatments. We need an infusion of hope. Patients with diabetes need to know that getting the best control usually requires a team approach. The patient and family should always be given the opportunity to work with a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator, as well as with a doctor who is experienced in treating diabetes. I believe every patient with diabetes should have access to an endocrinologist or diabetologist. I've heard too many stories from patients who aren't getting enough information or even the right kind of information. In far too many cases, the gatekeeper is not experienced in dealing with diabetes. A patient with cancer is typically sent to an oncologist. A patient with heart disease sees a cardiologist. So why is it not typical for a diabetic patient to see a diabetologist? I was on another run through Elmwood and Memorial Parks last week. It was muggy and the day was gathering dusk. As my legs stretched, pulling my quads and hamstrings taut, as my feet landed with a rhythmic thwack, 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 I felt strong. I felt capable and proud that my body could still run 4.5 miles, 19 years after I was diagnosed with diabetes. I've often had people tell me I'm a role model for diabetic patients. I cringe at that. I try to follow all the rules, but sometimes I deliberately disobey them. And not infrequently, I still feel disabled by diabetes. Even though I've been fairly successful in my life, in my career, there's no question in my life that diabetes has been a much bigger monster than I let on. It's a passive-aggressive monster. It promises to behave if I behave a certain way, and laughs in my face after it throws me a curveball. I'm very grateful I have a boss who lets me choose my work hours for the most part. After the birth of my second child 2.5 years ago, I chose to work part-time so I could spend more time with my kids. But working part-time also gives me much-needed time for a nap during the week when I'm exhausted. I'm also fortunate to work in my chosen profession. As a medical reporter, I have access to the latest studies, to doctors and researchers who are working on better treatments. Sometimes I become obsessed with diabetes, but I draw comfort from knowing many other diabetics feel the same way. In other words, I'm not crazy. I just live with a crazy disease. The physicality of diabetes is so large sometimes, so burdensome, so extraordinarily experienced that it tends to blot out everyday living. I like to think I'm successful, at least partially, in balancing my world. But my days are often punctuated by feelings of inadequacy, fatigue, and frustration. The hardest part is coming to terms with the knowledge that I'm living with a chronic illness that requires an intense amount of management. At the same time, the prevailing public opinion seems to be that if I'm failing, it's because I'm not trying hard enough. I'm grateful I don't have cancer. I'm grateful I don't have multiple sclerosis. I'm grateful that I'm not blind, deaf, or a quadriplegic. But that doesn't mean I should be thankful to have diabetes, just because its problems are more insidious, less visible, and more than any other illness, so utterly linked with patient responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Margaret. What a compelling and kind of a frightening story. We have time for a few questions, and I've tried to sort through them. Dr. Lane, the first, I'm going to lump several of them together for you. What can you tell us about transplants of insulin-producing pancreas cells? Talk about islet transplants as a treatment, and will there ever be a cure for diabetes?
Okay, good questions. Margaret brought up the idea about islet cell transplant. The ability to transplant organs with insulin-producing cells already exists, but right now we have to do it in the context of a whole pancreas. And the problem with that is that it takes a big surgery to put that in, and there are problems with how to drain the enzyme-producing cells that help to digest food, because if you don't do that, it digests itself, and it can be a problem. Since it's the insulin-producing cells that we want, the goal has always been to try to do islet transplants, and islets really refer to islands of cells called the islands of Langerhans that produce or that make insulin in the so-called beta cells in the islets. And as Margaret alluded to, over the last 2 years, islet cell transplantation has really taken off as the result of the Edmonton group showing that they can maintain individuals that have been transplanted with islets in an insulin-independent state. And as I said earlier, I was just back from the American Diabetes Association meetings, and now not only are we seeing these results in Edmonton, but they're being reproduced now at other institutions like the University of Miami, the University of Minnesota, and the National Institutes of Health. So I think that this is a technique and a treatment that can be universalized. And it is true that we have two physicians here that bring their expertise from the University of Washington to Omaha to start an islet cell transplant program. And it is new. On the other hand, we think that it is really the wave of the future. It's the way that we're going to be able to give islets in such a way that it will allow people to remain insulin independent and live a more regular and healthy life. But with all things, you know, it's not perfected yet, and there are some things that are new about it, and we're taking it one step at a time. But that is true that we do have individuals that are being evaluated for that. The biggest problem with islet cell transplant is that if we don't have enough islets to transplant to the individuals that really need it, because the donor pancreases from humans are limited. So it really raises the issue about how best to use our donated organs, how best to reach all those individuals who may at some point in time be potential organ donors that would want to have their organs shared through transplantation. And it also means that we really need to think about the development of other alternative sources. And there has been a lot of work that have been done with other cells from other animals, including pig, so-called xenotransplants, because they make an insulin that's very much like humans. I think that we are not yet at a cure for type 1 diabetes, but I think that more now than any other time, people are actually seeing in front of us that there is that potential of being able to render people insulin independent. One of the hardest things that we have when we take care of people who have pancreas transplants right now is to make sure and remind them that, yes, you got to go make sure you check your eyes, because even though that pancreas is working really well, you got to make sure that all those things that occurred before you got the transplant are still looked after. But, yes, I think that is in the offering, and it is down the way, and it looks more palpable and more real than it ever has.
Margaret, this one's for you. I know a number of black people with diabetes. I can't imagine a single one of them maintaining the disciplined regimen you keep with eating and exercising, et cetera. I can't imagine many people, period, doing that, actually. What do people of color with diabetes feel about cultural realities the research community needs to understand?
That's an excellent, excellent question. I wish I knew. Walter, was that you? that's such a good question, because I think that we need to treat African American patients culturally different, because their expectations are different. And I think we need to speak their language and work in a lifestyle that works for them. And I have a good friend at work who's African American and just was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. He is doing remarkably well. But he says, Margaret, I go to these offices and I see all these black people with diabetes and they're telling them, you know, cook all this food that these people have never eaten in their lives. They're telling them to cook white people food when they want to eat black people food. You know, so we got to pay attention. It's not going to work if you're going to try to. It's hard enough changing your lifestyle, but you got to work within the culture that you're working. And I think that the black culture is so predominantly affected by type 2 diabetes. They predominantly have more heart attacks and kidney failure and all the other complications that we need to begin a new way of treating blacks.
As long as you're nearby, you mentioned that your sister had diabetes. Was there any other indication? Does it run in your family other than you and your sister?
It does. I have a very strong family history of type 1, and type 2 typically runs in families. My grandfather on my father's side actually had type 2, but he subsequently had three of his 11 children develop type 1 diabetes. And they developed diabetes at later ages, like 20 and 30. My sister got it when she was 12. I got it when I was 20. A cousin on my father's side got it when she was a young girl, and my nephew got it when he was 5. So we have a very strong family history, and I often worry about my own kids.
Dr. Lane, when you were talking about foods and foods to avoid, you mentioned fat and salt. You didn't mention sugar. Why is that?
That's a great question. That's one of the most commonly asked questions of all times, because you'd think that if a person has too much sugar to begin with, that if you ate that in the diet, that would be detrimental. But the fact is that we recommend a diet that is roughly 50% carbohydrate, and about 30% of that is fat, and about 20% is protein. But if you take a usual, what we refer to as a Western diet, which means from the Western world or the modern world, as opposed to an Eastern diet or from the old world, our diets are enriched in fat. And so the typical Western diet might be 40-45% fat. And the problem with that is it's very high in saturated fats. And saturated fats are the bad kind because those are the ones that are most likely to cause more problems with cholesterol levels and have a higher risk when they're taken in large amounts with heart disease. So our goal here is not to limit carbohydrates, because you can't have a diet without them. Breads, cereals, all these things contain carbohydrates, and they're part of a balanced and healthy diet. But the things that probably do need to be excluded would be those things that contain excess amounts of fat, in addition to a lot of the simple sugars that come with cakes and candies and those kinds of things. So the goal is never to eliminate carbohydrates. An additional thing that Margaret referred to earlier was a matter of kind of keeping track of your carbohydrates. And more than anything, that's what we try to talk about, because it's really a matter of knowing how many carbohydrates you've taken so that you can match it with the treatment you're on or the insulin you're taking.
I'd like to thank our two guests today. I'd like to thank Dr. James Lane from UNMC for a wealth of information on the disease, the spread, and the growth of diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes among us. And I'd also like to thank KETV reporter Margaret Bowman for a fascinating story. Thank you both very much. I'd also like to personally thank Tom O'Connor of UNMC and the past Press Club president for arranging today's program. Our next program will be Thursday, August 22nd, here at the Press Club. The topic is Local Terrorist Attack. How would Omaha respond? That's on Thursday, August 22nd. I'd like to thank people in the audience for coming today, and I'd like to thank our listeners on KIOS. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's topic was diabetes, treatments, research, and the future. Our special guest speakers were Dr. James T. Lane, assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and a nationally recognized diabetes expert, and Margaret Bowman, medical reporter for KETV Channel 7 and herself an insulin-dependent diabetic. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, June 20th, 2002, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Chris Allen for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. If you would like to attend future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.